a novel about the hole-in-the-wall gang in an alternate reality 1890s. This one run as a feminist collective.
I sort of took this idea and tried to you know, play with it a little bit in my book. So in this book, you know, most of the real life hole-in-the-wall gang, they were men. In this book, they're all women or they're non-binary. And I sort of played to some degree with like the names of the original hole-in-the-wall gang outlaws. You know, there's a character named the Kid. There's a character, Cassie, who's sort of like a little bit named after Butch Cassidy. Some of the other characters have some names that are taken. News, I think there was a real member of the hole-in-the-wall gang who went by the nickname of News. So some of these names I found really evocative, and I tried to use them or use parts of them. But I wanted to create a really different type of, you know, quote-unquote gang, and kind of tap into the idea that these are people who, you know, yes, we're living as outlaws, but not necessarily by choice. And that they, you know, I mean, one reason I like the title of the book is that it emphasizes the fact that these people have been outlawed. You know, they've sort of been made illegal in their society through no fault of their own, and then have to figure out a way to live outside the law. And the way that they've decided to do it is, as you say, by creating this sort of commune, you know, out in a remote part of what is now, or what we would call, Wyoming, and really kind of developing their own laws and their own codes of living.
That's Anna North. We talk with her about her acclaimed new novel, Outlawed. Then, a novel that explores the temptations of corruption that can afflict us all.
I'm not sure that you have to be a fundamentally, completely awful Disney mustache-twirling villain to find yourself in a situation in a kind of gradually and then suddenly sort of way where you wake up one morning and you've drifted pretty far off what you would have assumed your moral compass to be. So, yeah, you know, I think that we're probably all more corruptible than we'd like to imagine, and that probably most of us could find ourselves in a situation where, you know, that the kind of drift, where you just kind of drifted a little bit too far without meaning to.
That's Emily St. John Mandel. She's back from her triumph with Station 11 with another novel exploring catastrophe, this time the 2008 financial collapse. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. The year is 1894, the place Wyoming. But this isn't the time and place we know as history. It's a counterfactual time and place, and America still recovering from a devastating pandemic. This is the setting for Anna North's wonderful novel, Outlawed. Featuring the young midwife Ada, a no-nonsense, courageous, and determined heroine, Outlawed dusts off the myth of the Old West and reignites the glimmering promise of the frontier with an entirely new set of feminist stakes. Outlawed is about the search for hope in the wake of death and for truth in a climate of small-mindedness and fear. The Washington Post called Outlawed the Western with a provocative blend of alt history and feminist consciousness. The result is a thrilling tale, eerily familiar but utterly transformed. Anna North is a journalist and novelist. Her journalistic work focuses on the politics of reproductive health. In addition to Outlawed, she's the author of two previous novels and is a senior reporter at Fox. Anna North, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Outlawed is a feminist Western set in a counterfactual Old West, an alternate late 19th century America. Tell us a little bit about that society and how you imagined it.
Yeah, so as you say, Outlawed is set in 1894, but it's not our 1894. It's an alternate 1894. In the world of the book, there was a devastating flu pandemic in 1830. I should say there actually was a flu pandemic in 1830 in the real world too, but it wasn't quite so devastating. It didn't, for example, destroy the United States. But in the book, it does. So the United States government is gone. Descendants of former Americans sort of live in these independent towns dotted you know, across the landscape. And they become really obsessed with reproduction. So there's sort of a desire to replace, you know, those who have been lost from the flu, and also a desire sort of for the sense of hope that childbearing can sometimes bring. And so fertility sort of becomes prized above all else, especially for women. And women who are infertile or called, you know, barren in this world are deeply stigmatized. They can even be hanged as witches. So within this world, we follow Ada, who marries at 17. And then after a year of marriage, she's not pregnant. She can't conceive a child. And so she's at great risk. She ends up fleeing her home and everything she knows. And she meets up with the mysterious Hole in the Wall gang and sort of has to decide whether she's going to go along with their dangerous plan to create sort of a haven for outcast women, or what she's going to do to sort of not only maintain her own safety, but find sort of her true calling in life.
Yes. And that true calling is very much centered on her medical work. She's a midwife, and she is really more of a doctor with a vast store of herbal knowledge. And as somebody who myself has been known to create my own tinctures and has been very interested in herbal medicine for a long time, I found that you were pretty knowledgeable yourself. Are you a practitioner?
No, I just did a lot of research. I've been interested in midwifery for a long time. So in my journalistic work, I cover a lot of reproductive health issues. And so I'd covered, you know, midwives and midwifery in the past. And even actually after finishing this book, have continued to cover these issues as they become sort of even more important in the pandemic. But no, for the book, I just did a lot of research trying to learn more about, you know, what it was like to be a midwife in the real life 19th century, what it's like to be a midwife today, you know, and what kinds of remedies might have been available then. And a lot of these, you know, as you say, a lot of these are still used. I mean, you know, something interesting is when I was working on the book, when I was finishing up the book, I actually got pregnant myself. So as I was sort of finishing the final chapters, you know, I was pregnant and then actually had my son. And, you know, even just learning about, you know, all the things that are recommended sometimes for, you know, things like, you know, fenugreek for increasing milk supply, things like that, you know, really haven't changed in hundreds of years and are still recommended today. So as you say, some of these things, you know, are old, but also continue to be used.
Did you try that?
I did try fenugreek. I'm not sure whether it worked or not. You know, I ended up, I think really part of the problem for me was just that pumping is no fun. And I went back to work and was pumping, but I did try. Maybe it helped a little.
Yes, pumping is definitely no fun.
Yeah.
Now, talk about how Ada, being a midwife, puts her in a precarious position in a society that, after all, is prizing fertility above all else.
Yeah. So, I mean, something that I wanted to focus on in the book is sort of, I didn't want this book to be a straight up dystopia. So whereas there are aspects of this world that are, you know, much worse probably for a lot of people than real life 1894 or certainly real life today, you know, there were aspects that are just different or where people even are able to carve out a certain level of autonomy. And midwives are sort of one example. So this is a society that really praises, you know, and values fertility and reproduction. So women who have a lot of children actually, you know, have a decent amount of social power. We see this with Ada's mother, who is able to divorce her husband and live singly, and nobody really bothers her. She runs her own business as a midwife. Nobody really bothers her. So she's very prized, you know, not only because she's been fertile herself, but also because she has this role in sort of the whole community's fertility. And then Ada becomes an apprentice to her and sort of, you know, is in the process of learning the trade and learning the skill set when she sort of has to flee. So it puts her in an interesting position where she actually has the ability and a lot of the knowledge that she needs to investigate her own situation, to investigate, you know, why she and other women in this world might be infertile, you know, just to investigate fertility and reproduction generally, which is what she really wants to do. You know, but of course, as someone who's deeply stigmatized, she's constantly in danger. So she has to really find a safe way to kind of do the kind of inquiry that she wants to do.
And this is, of course, an extremely patriarchal society. Why did you choose it as a patriarchy as opposed, say, a matriarchy, because, you know, mothers are so prized?
Right. It's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, I tried to maintain tiny elements maybe of not, if not matriarchy, then certainly elements of valuing motherhood and the concept of mothers in a certain way. So for example, in, you know, the form of Christianity that a lot of the people practice is really very focused on the Virgin Mary, focused on the saints who are mothers, things like this. You know, but it's true in America today and a lot of societies today that valuing mothers and motherhood doesn't necessarily translate to giving women power. You know, and so I think for me in writing this society, I was just thinking about to some degree what, you know, real life would have been like for women in the 1890s, what real life is still like for many women today. And, you know, just thinking about even in a society where fertility is prized, there have been many societies like that. And you could say, you know, maybe ours still is one a little bit. It's not necessarily the case that women get power through that, even if perhaps they're able to get a little bit more power, relatively speaking, if they do have a lot of children or if they are involved in fertility in some way.
Yeah, and in fact, prizing motherhood may make women more subject to control. Talk about the patriarchal trope of the barren woman who is dangerous, as you know, which is such a familiar concept, really. I mean, this is not counterfactual, but talk about in the context of this novel, Outlawed, Anna North.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you know, this is something that we've sort of seen throughout history. And, you know, in the book, we see women who are barren sort of seen as this potentially very dangerous force in their communities. People blame them, you know, if someone gets sick or if a baby dies, you know, or if someone else is infertile, people blame the existing infertile women in the community, try to oust them or even worse, you know. And so these are things, you know, these specific things are sort of things that I invented, and the specific scenario with the pandemic, you know, these are things that I invented, although obviously, unfortunately, another pandemic has come to pass. But I certainly didn't invent the concept of, you know, sort of women being stigmatized or persecuted for falling outside whatever the norms are of their sort of their sex lives and their reproductive lives. So, you know, we see this back in the Salem witch trials. You know, we see women sort of who are perceived as having a deviant sexuality or perceived as having deviated in some way from the norms of the wives and mothers that they're supposed to be, you know, frequently being persecuted, being ostracized, being accused of witchcraft, you know, being seen as dangerous to the patriarchal order in a variety of ways. I mean, we've even seen this for midwives, right? I mean, I think it's Barbara Ehrenreich who talks about midwives in Europe really being stigmatized as witches because these were women who in some ways had the power of life and death. They were women who brought life into the world. And so that's very powerful. It was threatening to sort of male-dominated social orders, and some of them got hanged as a result. So, you know, in terms of, again, you know, the specific situations in the book are ones that I invented, but you don't have to go very far to find situations in history or even in the present that are quite similar.
Yeah, and I'd like to actually get back to that a little bit later. So let's get back to the story here. Ada, as you said, joins the Hole in the Wall gang. First, just tell us who were the original Hole in the Wall gang, and then tell us about this kind of bank-robbing feminist commune that it is in this book, Outlawed.
Sure. So the real-life Hole in the Wall gang were a real gang of outlaws in the late 19th century. Their leaders were Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You know, a sort of a loosely knit group of outlaws. Different people would come in and out at different times. There were women in the gang, at least one woman. There was a woman named Laura Bullion, who was a little bit the model of the character of Agnes Rose in the book, not completely, but sort of. Yeah, and they lived at the Hole in the Wall in Wyoming, which is a hideout, and you can still see it today. There's actually a working ranch called Willow Creek Ranch that's on the site of the old Hole in the Wall gang hideout. But they chose it, you know, this particular rock formation, the Hole in the Wall, was really advantageous for sort of looking out across this whole valley and seeing any intruders who might be coming to attack you. So it was a great place for an outlaw hideout. In general, outlaws would try to hide out in places that were difficult for, you know, sheriffs and other folks to sneak up on. So this was one. And yeah, sort of a loose-knit gang of robbers and crooks. And I sort of took this idea and tried to, you know, play with it a little bit in my book. So in this book, you know, most of the real life Hole in the Wall gang, they were men. In this book, they're all women or they're non-binary. And I sort of played to some degree with like the names of the original Hole in the Wall gang, Outlaws. You know, there's a character named the Kid. There's a character, Cassie, who's sort of like a little bit named after Butch Cassidy. Some of the other characters have some names that are taken. News, I think there was a real member of the Hole in the Wall gang who went by the nickname of News. So some of these names I found really evocative, and I tried to use them or use parts of them. But I wanted to create a really different type of, you know, quote unquote gang, and kind of tap into the idea that these are people who, you know, yes, we're living as outlaws, but not necessarily by choice. And that they, you know, I mean, one reason I like the title of the book is that it emphasizes the fact that these people have been outlawed. You know, they've sort of been made illegal in their society through no fault of their own, and then have to figure out a way to live outside the law. And the way that they've decided to do it is, as you say, by creating this sort of commune, you know, out in a remote part of what is now, or what we would call, Wyoming, and really kind of developing their own laws and their own codes of living.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Anna North about her new novel, Outlawed. It takes place in an alternate reality, 1894, several decades after a devastating pandemic has reconfigured American society. And you mentioned the Kid. That's a very interesting character in this book. Tell us about the Kid.
Yeah, so the Kid in the book is the leader of the Hole in the Wall gang. And, you know, the Kid was one of the most difficult characters in some way to write, because I wanted to write a character who was a very strong leader, but also a flawed leader, and, you know, someone who would be complex, someone who could hold the gang together. But the Kid doesn't necessarily always have the perfect plans or the best ideas, you know, and there are flaws there. And so I think of the Kid as someone whose like greatest strength is the ability to inspire people. And, you know, not necessarily, you know, to make plans, and not necessarily, like, you know, this one aspect of leadership in particular, the Kid is really good at. And that's sort of this inspirational aspect. The Kid, you know, is descended from pastors and has this gift sort of preaching and a gift with the Bible. That was also important to me. I wanted to, you know, have the book have sort of characters with multiple different approaches to religion. I didn't want... you know, I didn't want to send the message that this is a world where religion only functions for repression. I don't think that's true in our world. I think it's simplistic. And so I wanted to complicate that a little bit. And so, you know, in the book, the Kid really uses religion and sort of the language of religion to inspire the Kid's own self as well as others. You know, and also, another thing about the Kid is that the Kid is probably now, if the Kid were alive, they might identify as non-binary, but in the book, they don't really use those terms. So the Kid doesn't use pronouns in the book. At one point, a character says the Kid is just the Kid. That actually turned out to be, you know, when I first had that idea, I thought it might be complicated to write, but it actually began to flow very naturally. And really sort of the Kid's gender identity was kind of an early part of the Kid's character for me, something that I really... you know, was important to me early on, just when I was sort of dreaming these characters up.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anna North, a journalist and a novelist, about her newest novel, Outlawed. So this group, the Hole in the Wall gang, they're not just gender nonconforming, but racially integrated as well. Talk a little bit about that theme in the book and where that, you know, where you kind of got that from as you were developing this novel?
Sure. So, you know, I would say for me, you know, the ways that racism and indeed eugenics come up in the book, those were some of the hardest for me to write. You know, I'm white. And I think for me, trying to approach these issues and approach them in a way that was smart and realistic and made sense, like, I had to really do a lot of work. And I'm sure there are ways in which I'm falling short, but hopefully, you know, we'll get better over time. But yeah, I think, you know, for me, it was important. I remember going through early drafts of this with my writing group, and one person sort of made the note that it seemed like I was writing about a world in which, you know, misogyny was rampant, but racism didn't really exist. And so I wanted to make sure that doesn't sound like a realistic world to me. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, that I sort of dealt with both. And it also seemed to me that in any society that was obsessed with reproduction, that there would be people in that society who would become obsessed with the kinds of racist ideas that we see in the eugenics movement, you know, ideas about purity, ideas about sort of quote unquote racial mixing. You know, certainly this is something that we saw in the US and we still see in the US. And so I wanted to make sure that that, you know, sort of was represented and that people who push back against that were represented, you know. And I think it was also a way for me to kind of look at the role of science in this world, because we have in the world of Outlawed, we have Ada, who, as you mentioned, is a midwife and kind of a doctor and really cares a lot about science and wants to use science to, you know, to sort of destigmatize her own barrenness and to help other people who, you know, deal with various kinds of marginalization and stigma. But then on the flip side, we have a character named Dr. Lively, who is really, you know, sort of using his own brand of science to push racism and to push, you know, what we would in our world probably call eugenics. And so in the same way that I wanted to show religion having different roles in this world, I also wanted to show sort of science having different roles. And I wanted to show that, you know, while Ada sort of believes that she can solve a lot of the problems in her world just if everyone had more knowledge. And I have a lot of sympathy with that view. I'm certainly a fan of science, but I wanted to show too the ways that people have sort of in real life and in the world of this book have kind of promulgated racism in the name of science too.
Yeah, and it wasn't lost on me that Dr. Lively is also selling some snake oil.
Yes.
So this is an alternate history, as we've been talking about, but also, as we've seen, it's not that different in many ways from real history, not only the past, but the present and possibly the future. You are the gender reporter for Vox. That is, you cover reproductive justice issues and other gender issues. How much did your day job influence your fiction?
Yeah, certainly a fair amount. I would say, you know, my journalism and my fiction have always kind of informed each other, but I think especially with this book, that was true. You know, and as you say, I cover a lot of issues of reproductive health. During the pandemic, I've also, you know, transitioned to covering a lot of issues around care and care work and childcare. You know, and all these issues came into play, you know, although I finished the book a while ago, but certainly my coverage of reproductive health came into play. And it's actually, you know, they have cross-pollinated also the two sort of strands of my career. So, you know, I wrote this book that was, you know, focused on someone who's a midwife's daughter and an apprentice midwife. And then, you know, have remained really interested in midwifery and in sort of the history of midwives in the United States. And I get into that a little bit in the book, you know, but it remains really relevant today because, you know, in the 19th century, so right around, you know, when Ada is at work as a midwife, is when midwives sort of began to be pushed out of the delivery room and began to be pushed out of you know, the practice of birth by male doctors and by, you know, their sort of associations. And that's had really devastating effects. I mean, midwife care is very valuable, and people in the U.S. don't really get it, especially not in the same way as they get it in other countries that are sort of our comparison countries. You know, and so I think writing this book gave me a real new appreciation for midwives, but, you know, reporting and talking to midwives has also done so. And it's, you know, and as I think I said before, it has become an even more pressing issue during the pandemic as more people were concerned about giving birth in hospitals. There's been increasing demand for midwife care and for home birth care. Not every midwife attends a home birth, but all these issues, you know, I think they were swirling around in my head, you know, in my journalism before I wrote the book, and just only came into clearer focus, you know, as I worked on and finished this book.
Well, that's so interesting. And talk a little bit more about the impact of the pandemic on reproductive justice issues. I mean, we are facing, you know, a Supreme Court that could overturn Roe versus Wade. We're facing a GOP, which is trying to impose minority rule, and certainly control of women's reproduction is part of that. Where do you see us going? And do you see any signs of, you know, of fighting back? Because I think for so many years, you know, women just assumed that we had the right to choose. And we didn't fight back when it might have nipped things in the bud.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been an interesting couple of years to cover reproductive health. I remember I remember that the last travel assignment I went on right before lockdown last year was to visit the Supreme Court for the Louisiana case, so June Medical Services, which was a case that some were concerned was going to overturn Roe. At a minimum, people were very worried that the case could open the door for a lot more restrictions on abortion clinics around the country, you know, based on this one lawsuit out of Louisiana. And that didn't happen. You know, the Supreme Court ruled in such a way that struck down the Louisiana law and, you know, didn't end up paving the way for these restrictions the way that people feared. You know, but obviously we saw, you know, the proliferation of different kinds of restrictions in the pandemic, you know, whether it was you know, clinics getting closed because abortions were deemed non-essential services, you know, whether it was simply just people lacking access. I heard a lot of stories and saw data, you know, it was very difficult to access not just abortion, but birth control, a variety of reproductive health services when people didn't feel safe going to clinics because of concern for the virus, you know, and when clinic staffs had to be reduced. It was just like a really difficult time for anyone at any point in their reproductive lives who needed any kind of care. And of course, now that we see this year, we see again, you know, a big proliferation of abortion restrictions. We're seeing new abortion bans coming into play in I believe Arkansas and elsewhere. I mean, that's been interesting for me to watch too, because of course there was that enormous wave of very strict abortion bans in 2019. And the interesting thing about that is what a huge backlash there was. So you'll remember the protesters in the Handmaid's outfits, you know, enormous protests throughout the country. And really, you know, a real popular groundswell of people saying like, no, we don't want this to be banned. And I think there was a lot of sense, even among some abortion opponents, that they had overplayed their hand. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out over the next few years, because I think, you know, just if you look at public opinion, for all that abortion can seem like a controversial issue in America, ultimately, Roe v. Wade has enormous support and people want the basic right to be there by a large majority. So it's going to be very interesting for me to see what happens as states continue to chip away at that. But I think to some degree, a lot of activists were woken up in 2019. I mean, a lot of people were awake to this already, but I think I just don't think it's going to be so easy to roll back some of these things. But, you know, I do think it's going to be a difficult fight.
Well, we'll be following that fight along with your work on it in Vox, and also reading your fiction. We've been speaking with you, Anna North, about your most recent novel, Outlawed. It's a terrific read. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thanks so much. This was fun.
Anna North. Find links to the book and to her other work at writersvoice.net. Next up, The Glass Hotel. Don't go away. That was music from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. And if you missed part of this interview, and if you missed part of this week's show, you can go find it there. With her fourth novel, Station 11, Emily St. John Mandel broke into star status in the literary realm. Now, in The Glass Hotel, she's come out with a captivating story of crisis and survival during the financial collapse of 2008. Featuring a Bernie Madoff-like Ponzi scheme, The Glass Hotel asks the question, do each of us have a price? And what determines it? The Glass Hotel is a fascinating portrait of greed and guilt, love and delusion, ghosts and unintended consequences. Well, Emily St. John Mandel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, I want to say I completely loved your last novel, Station 11. It was the third book you published, but the first one I read. So I was looking forward to this one, and it did not disappoint. So in this novel, we have the protagonist, Vincent, named after Edna St. Vincent Millay. She grew up in a place in British Columbia called Cayette, where some of the action takes place. And it's a place where she lost her mother at the age of 13. Tell us about Vincent and this place and what role it plays in this book.
Vincent might be my favorite of all the characters I've ever written. She's a very self-possessed person. She's very intelligent. She is a little bit aimless. It's kind of a, I don't know if you'd call that a fatal flaw, but it's a problem she has. Because, of course, being very intelligent isn't the same thing as knowing what you want to do with your life. And that's something she struggles with. She's just a very calm, self-directed kind of a person. When we meet her, she's a bartender in a hotel in this place that you mentioned, Cayette. So Cayette, the hotel, I regret to report, is fictional. I wish I could stay there, but I made it up. The place itself, if you were to Google Cuatzino, British Columbia, you would find a place very similar to Cayette. So I grew up in British Columbia, but where I grew up, you know, it was a small island. It was really more inconvenient than remote. It really wasn't that far out. It was a 10-minute ferry ride to Vancouver Island. But when I was about 14, my family and I went to stay for a couple of weeks in the home of a friend in Cuatzino. And it was so remote. It's the most remote place I've ever visited. You drive to the far northern tip of Vancouver Island. You drive until you run out of roads, and then you take a water taxi. And the water taxi will take you to a community of about, I want to say about 85 or 90 people. The only infrastructure is a small pier, a post office about the size of my office. It's not big. There's a tiny little church from the 1850s, and that's about it. You know, kids, any school-aged children there would go to school on the mailboat, which is what it sounds like. That's the boat that ferries the outgoing mail to the nearest larger community. So, you know, I stayed there for 2 weeks. I loved it. It was so beautiful. It was a place I'd always kind of wanted to write about. I kind of had this feeling that I didn't necessarily have the right to write about it because I didn't, after all, know it that well. You know, I was there for 2 weeks. So I fictionalized it a little bit and gave it a different name, but it's based very closely on that real place.
Mm. Yes. And it really, it also plays a contrast to, you know, the centers of the financial universe, because this book takes place against the backdrop of the financial crisis of 2008. And it involves a Ponzi scheme. Tell us about the Ponzi scheme that is at the center of this book.
So something I like to emphasize is that every character in this book is completely fictional. However, readers who are following American financial news around 2008, 2009 will recognize the central crime in the book. It is based very closely on Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme, which collapsed in December 2008. That crime fascinated me, partly just for its scale. You know, a $65 billion with a B U.S. Ponzi scheme. Like the number of people affected was just astronomical. But then also because there was a staff, which is such a weird part of this crime. But, you know, this was a tremendously far-reaching fraud. There were thousands of individuals and businesses who were supposedly invested with this scheme. And, you know, if you're a billionaire, you're not going to sit there and format those fake account statements all by yourself. You've got people for that. So about 6 or 7 of Madoff's staffers went to prison for their role in the crime. And at the time when that story broke, I had a really great day job for a writer. I was an administrative assistant in a cancer research lab at the Rockefeller University in New York. And I really adored my coworkers. They were all such smart people, which, as we all know, is by no means a given in any office environment. The work itself was really interesting. And what I found myself thinking about was just the camaraderie that one has with any group of people where you're going to work together every day. There's that sense of shared mission. Now, imagine how much wilder and more surreal and stranger that camaraderie would be if that shared mission were a massive crime. Like, you're showing up at work on Monday morning to defraud people. It's just kind of mind-blowing to me to imagine what that office environment might look like. So that was the starting point for the book and the part that fascinated me the most about that crime.
I wonder if your coworkers, what they would feel about being the inspiration for the characters engaged in this Ponzi scheme in this book. You know, while I was reading this, it really occurred to me, because I remember that time very, very well, as most of us probably do. And I was thinking, you know, isn't the whole financial system akin to a Ponzi scheme? You know, a journalist in this book, in The Glass Hotel, in your novel, Emily St. John Mandel, she visits the central character, and the other central character, who we'll get to in a moment, Jonathan Alcaides, the head of the Ponzi scheme. She visits him in prison, and she says, "So in order for your scheme to succeed for as long as it did, a great many people had to believe in a story that didn't actually make sense, but everyone was making money, so no one cared." And that really struck me because I remember interviewing somebody who had been involved in the financial industry before the crash and wrote a book after it. And I heard the exact same thing from them. You know, I asked them, "Didn't you know this was going on?" And they said, "Yeah, but, you know, we were all making money and nobody wanted to do it."
Right. It's a fascinating dynamic, isn't it? I mean, if you look at Madoff's returns now, you can find samples of account statements online. You can graph those returns at a 45-degree upward angle. It makes absolutely no sense. It correlates with nothing. You know, somebody quite close to me was involved in that. They were a Madoff investor. And what he'll say about those years in retrospect is, you know, we used to get these account statements. We would pore over them. They made no sense. We could never figure out where the numbers were coming from. But we were all making so much money, so we just kind of shrugged it off. And it is fascinating to realize that, of course, that would have been everybody's experience, you know, including Steven Spielberg's financial advisors. And I'm going to go on a limb and suggest that he probably has the best people out there. So, yeah, it's like this kind of mass delusion took hold. Or maybe it's that thing that all successful con artists have where they make you want to believe.
Yeah. And now talk a little bit more about him. And actually, I'm going to ask this question by going back to Vincent, because to me, she was a real contrast. She seems to be a fundamentally a good person who has real integrity. She may drift, but she does the right thing. You know, I couldn't imagine her doing a Ponzi scheme. And yet, of course, she gets involved with Alcaides because she becomes this kind of trophy wife. I mean, she doesn't marry him. She's his girlfriend. She's got to understand, you know, maybe is she also deluding herself?
To some extent, yeah. You know, what she grapples with, I see this novel as being so much about responsibility and culpability. And when Jonathan's arrested, she's blindsided. But then as the years pass, you know, her real arc in the book is having to question whether that's true. Like, was she really blindsided? Can she really say she had no idea that anything was wrong? Because this is a very intelligent person who, although she does have this kind of basic integrity, you know, as you just alluded to, and she's fundamentally a good person, she did allow herself to be swept up in something really questionable. You know, she agreed to pretend to be somebody's wife. Like, there's no really legitimate reason to do that, you know, that I can imagine. So what she has to come to grips with through the course of the novel is just this idea that, well, I did know. I must have known that something was amiss.
And yet she did have a reason. I mean, she had the precarity of having been a bartender, somebody who had no money, really. Yeah. So you talk about, you know, the difficult choices that, you know, good people are put into where their moral compass is challenged.
You know, I mentioned earlier that the first part of the book I started writing concerned the office staff, and I saw them as falling into that same category. I'm not sure that you have to be a fundamentally, completely awful Disney mustache twirling villain to find yourself in a situation in a kind of gradually and then suddenly sort of way where you wake up one morning and you've drifted pretty far off what you would have assumed your moral compass to be. So, yeah, you know, I think that we're probably all more corruptible than we'd like to imagine, and that probably most of us could find ourselves in a situation where, you know, that kind of drift, where you just kind of drifted a little bit too far without meaning to.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with novelist Emily St. John Mandel about her new book, The Glass Hotel. It was listed as one of the year's best books by The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Time, and more. And then, you know, let's go to Jonathan, actually, because he's also a confusing character. He's, of course, not fundamentally a person of integrity.
No.
but he is a likable guy. And I had a sense that even though he's a fraud, well, I guess I'll ask you, is his likability real? Or is it just part of the charm he uses to lure people in?
I would say a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. He was the hardest character to write because, you know, here's the thing with the Madoff crime. The crime itself is fascinating in its scale and duration and the number of people involved in it. The criminal is not. You know, if you read interviews with Madoff from prison, he just comes across as such a garden variety sociopath. Like, he's just, he was so uninteresting to me. So I didn't have any kind of template, really, for Jonathan's character. And then the real challenge with a character like that is, how do you make that interesting? You know, because obviously this is not a fundamentally good person. He's doing a terrible thing. But if he's 100% bad, that's kind of implausible. And it's kind of boring. You know, it's like, you know, I mentioned Disney villains earlier. Those old school Disney villains, they've gotten more nuanced over the years. But, you know, when I was a kid, you would know who the villain was from the first frame, like the way they were drawn. You know, it was just so kind of two-dimensional and obvious. So then how do you write a villain who has a little more nuance to his character? And yeah, so, you know, there are good things about his personality. He does have a capacity for love and friendship and kindness. And also, he's a terrible person in a lot of ways. So, yeah, I could see how that character would be confusing. He was quite difficult to write. It was an interesting process.
Yeah. And I mean confusing as a compliment, actually.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And now another thing is, you know, as we've already alluded to, is kind of, you know, the vast income inequality that informs this novel. And, you know, Vincent grew up poor. She had a single mother who then dies at an early age. I mean, she's, you know, she's in very straitened circumstances. When she becomes Alcaides' girlfriend, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. Is that right?
I go with Alcaides, but I don't know that I'd ever heard anybody pronounce it before I put it in the novel. So I feel like anything works.
Okay, we'll say Alcaides. Alcaides' girlfriend. She talks about money being its own country. And she very much inhabits that country like an immigrant. Talk about money being its own country and her relationship to that.
Sure, absolutely. You know, there are some autobiographical elements there. My family also had no money when I was growing up. And to be clear, it was a great upbringing. I'm very close with my parents, so I have no serious complaints. But then in adulthood, when I found myself moving around among people who'd grown up with more money than I had, there was a feeling of being an immigrant in a foreign country in a way that has nothing to do with the Canada-US border. You know, there are different expectations that one has of the way the world works and what one might expect from it based on where you grew up and the socioeconomic ladder. And it's sometimes quite striking. You know, I'll come across these sort of sociological differences. So I have had a feeling for a long time that money is its own country. And to be clear, I'm not hanging out with billionaires. You know, there are probably several countries on that ladder. But maybe one way of thinking about it is best described by example. So about 6 months before the pandemic started, so I suppose it would have been October 2019, I had the opportunity to go to Los Angeles a couple of times for a screenwriting project that I'm involved in. And because I had an epic promotional tour for my previous novel, Station 11, I'd collected an incredible number of miles on Delta Airlines. So on both occasions that I went to Los Angeles, I used those miles to upgrade to first class for a return flight, flying overnight from LAX to New York City. And the way that played out both times is, you know, your plane takes off around 10:30 p.m. from Los Angeles. You recline your bed to 180 degrees, pull up this comfortable duvet, have a very pleasant nap, wake up in the morning as the flight lands in New York City, and, you know, you just get on with your day. And I remember having this really odd feeling both times, like, you can't tell me those are two different cities. You know, it was like the ease and the frictionlessness of the experience had rendered the distance kind of implausible. I just sort of felt like this continuous experience. And it seems to me that having an enormous amount of money would kind of be a similar experience, that even though you might be moving between London, Vancouver, Singapore, you know, wherever, I think that would all feel so smooth that it would kind of feel like you were moving across the same place.
It's almost as if the real foreign country is on the other side of the bulkhead.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And having been on both sides of the bulkhead, including for flights from the United States to Australia, I can definitely attest to that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Emily St. John Mandel about her new novel, The Glass Hotel. It is a wonderful novel. So Alcatus actually has his own country that he inhabits like a stranger, and that's prison.
Yeah.
And he finds himself moving back and forth between prison and what he calls the counterlife. What is the counterlife, and is it a place where he experiences some regrets?
I think it is. The counterlife is your counterfactual life. That's the life that didn't happen. We all have one or dozens. You could think of it as the life where you went to a different school or married a different person or immigrated instead of staying or vice versa. So in other words, the life where you became a completely different person doing something quite different, you know, depending on where you went at one inflection point or another. For Jonathan, you know, he's losing his grip on reality. He has these daydreams of an alternate life where he fled to Dubai, which has no extradition treaty with the United States. So that would have been objectively smarter than hanging around New York. And as time passes, he becomes less and less certain of which life is real. And I don't know, I guess there's sort of an element of horror in that for me, of losing your grip on reality. But I've always really been fascinated by that idea that we could have lived any number of other lives. And then in this book, there's this ghost story element where at first when I was writing the book, the only ghosts were the ghosts of investors who Al-Qaeda sees in prison. But then it became kind of interesting to me to think, well, what is a ghost story? What else could that mean? Because it seems to me that we think of that phrase, ghost story, in these kind of narrowly classical terms where, you know, we think about the specter wafting translucently down the hallway in the Victorian mansion, like that kind of thing. But what if your life is haunted by your counterlives? And that idea is just so interesting to me. And it was kind of fun to play that out in this book.
Yes, yes. You know, one thing really struck me about this book, and that is its construction. In fact, one reviewer called it flawlessly constructed. And when I saw that, I said, yes. How did you work at constructing it? Because there are so many different strands, there are different characters, there are movements back and forth in time. But at the end, it all comes together almost like a magician's trick.
Well, thank you. There is nothing effortless happening there. You know, the structure of the book was easily the hardest thing. So I feel like the book I've always been trying to emulate, structurally speaking, is Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. But I love that novel. I'm fascinated by its structure. And for any listeners who aren't familiar, that's a book that moves forward and then backward in time in a perfectly symmetrical way. So you could kind of map it out as like A, B, C, D, C, B, A, where every letter is a different point of view and a different point in time. So that was the first structure I tried for The Glass Hotel. It turned out to be incredibly challenging because if you're committed to returning to exactly the same point in time and exactly this set order from a set perspective, it's really hard to maintain any kind of narrative tension. So that didn't work. So my first round editorial notes, I feel like I'm not exaggerating when I say that the notes were, could you please change absolutely everything? You know, the structure was the biggest part. So then I rewrote the book with, and I shouldn't say rewrote, I reordered the entire book and rewrote certain sections with just like a, you know, some variation on that to try to speed it up a little bit. And that still didn't work. So the final structure, you know, it's just kind of what I came to after really intensive revisions with three editors over a period of months and months. There is still some echo of that original symmetry, you know, in the way that the book begins and ends at the same moment in time with Vincent. But yeah, it was incredibly challenging. This book took me 5 years to write, which is about twice my average. You know, Station 11 was 2.5 years. And getting the structure right was the hardest part of that. I just had to redo it so many times before it worked.
Wow. And talking about Station 11, that book was written before the COVID pandemic, but it centers around a post-pandemic collapse society. I'm curious, what have been your thoughts as the real-life pandemic has played out over the past year?
It's been kind of a strange experience, if we can be honest here. You know, it has been for everybody. You know, the thing with Station 11 is that I predicted nothing. There, something that becomes very clear if you research the history of pandemics is that there will always be another pandemic. And that's not to say that it had to be this bad. You know, the way people and governments respond determines how bad the pandemic is as an experience. But it was always going to happen again. So, yeah, it's been a very strange year of talking about this very fictionalized, sort of scientifically implausible pandemic in Station 11. Well, we're all living through a real one. It is strange.
Yeah. And so both novels involve a before and after, basically, society-wide collapse. I'm wondering if you're going to tackle the climate crisis next, or are you done with before and after society-wide collapses?
I might be done with that for the moment. And, you know, it's funny. I had a profile in New York magazine, which called Disaster Artist. I just thought, oh, my God, no, that was never my intent. You know, with Station 11, the real project was I wanted to write about a post-technological society. You know, what does the world look like when our iPhones no longer work? But of course, if you're going to end technology, which is to say civilization, you've got to get from point A to point B. So I put in a pandemic. That just seemed like a terribly efficient way to end everything. And then with The Glass Hotel, I was inspired by this specific point in history, the 2008-2009 economic collapse, and by this specific crime. But yeah, I recognize that the picture is of, you know, this writer writing about complete societal collapses. No, my next novel... I've actually written a new novel over the course of the pandemic, and it's very strange because I wrote it in lockdown. I would call it almost utopian, you know, because a lot of it's set in the future, including on moon colonies. But, you know, there's a book tour in it, and I feel like any sci-fi future with a book tour in it, like that's sort of utopian by definition.
Say more about that.
More about that? Oh, sure. More about the novel or about utopian book tours?
About the utopian book tour.
You know, I feel like you can go in one of two directions when you're writing about the future. You can write Station 11, where society has collapsed and people are rebuilding from scratch. Or you can write Star Trek. And, you know, if you think about Star Trek, it really stands in counterpoint to dystopias and post-apocalyptic works. Because, you know, in Star Trek, civilization didn't collapse. There is a united federation of planets. And that's inspiring. I would call that a utopian vision of the future. So, yeah, the new novel is definitely more on the Star Trek end than the Station 11 end.
Well, I hope we can talk about that new novel when it gets published.
Well, that would be such a pleasure.
Emily Mandel, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you now about this novel, the latest, The Glass Hotel. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for interviewing me. This is really fun.
Emily St. John Mandel. Read an excerpt from The Glass Hotel by going to writersvoice.net. And here's a sneak preview from next week's show. We spend the hour with Simon Winchester, author of a slew of books about fascinating things, including the 1908 San Francisco earthquake, the Pacific Ocean, the Oxford English Dictionary, and now Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. We've talked with you before about oceans. You've written about the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean in two different books. You've written about volcanoes, earthquakes, scientists of various sorts. Now, land. What guides you in picking your subjects?
A variety of things, really. Sometimes one book leads naturally to another. I mean, for instance, back in the days of The Professor and the Madman, my editor, the late, beloved and long lamented Larry Ashmead, said, "What characterizes this book is a series of criteria. Can you think of anybody else that has those same criteria? And weren't you once a geologist?" And that led me from writing about W.C. Minor and the making of the Oxford English Dictionary to a chap called William Smith and the construction of the first geological map of anywhere. And that geology book, I think, led to Krakatoa, because someone said, "Well, why don't we see if there are any more stories from geology?" And that led to the San Francisco earthquake. So a variety of things. In this particular case, the land book came about largely because of a breakfast time discussion my wife and I were having about immigration, of all things, and the thought that an awful lot of the people that came to this country in the 1700s came because they'd been dispossessed of their land in England because of these newfangled laws that have collectively come to be known as the clearances. And that got us thinking, or what is ownership? What were the clearances? What did ownership mean? And so, very long-winded reply to your question, but basically a variety of reasons, but normally a discussion followed by a light going off. I wonder if that might be a good subject for a book.
And here's a sneak preview from next week's show. We spend the hour with Simon Winchester, author of a slew of books about fascinating things, including the 1908 San Francisco earthquake, the Pacific Ocean, the Oxford English Dictionary, and now Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.